Greetings, everybody. This is Brent Miller. Welcome to the Misadventuring Podcast, and here is your host, Carla King.
Our guest today is Ted Simon, who's best known as the best-selling author of the motorcycle travel classic Jupiter's Travels, about his trip around the world starting in 1973 at age 46. The trip lasted 4 years and covered 78,000 miles. Before the trip, Ted had been employed as a journalist and wrote for English newspapers such as the Daily Mail, the Observer, and the Times. After the success of Jupiter's Travels, he followed up with a part two for the book called Riding High, with all the good stuff he couldn't put in the first book. Later, he wrote The Gypsy in Me, a book detailing his search for his father's roots in Eastern Europe. And in a fit of passion against the dam builders who were on a mission to ruin the environment in the lovely place where he lives, Ted was compelled to write another book, The River Stops Here, Saving Round Valley, a pivotal chapter in California's water wars. I called Ted at his home in Covelo, California. Here's the recording.
Ted Simon's latest book is Dreaming of Jupiter, the story about his 2001 motorcycle journey that traces the steps of his first to see how the world had changed. He started this three-year trip when he was 69. Ted, welcome to the Misadventuring Podcast.
Hello.
So what I wanted to start with, your books have inspired many people to set off on their own life journey, but what I want to explore with you today is how your personal journey unfolded. How did you get here, starting with, did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
I think I just found out when I was at school that I could write. I think I remember the seminal moment was we had a rather good English teacher, an elderly guy who was very nice, and I wrote something, you know, one of those essays we were all supposed to write, and I think I put in it something about a man with a ferrule on the end of his walking stick. I don't quite remember what I said or how I said it, but he was entranced by this because obviously it was very rare for him to find anybody in his class who actually had an eye for detail. And for some reason, that has stuck with me and made me think for the first time in my life that maybe I knew something about how to write that other people didn't. So that goes back to the age of 15, I think. And then I, after that, did a little bit of writing here and there just for the fun of it. But really, I was going to be a chemist, not a writer. It was only when chemistry failed me that I thought I might be able to make something out of writing.
I see. So you were employed at a few different newspapers in the UK.
It was all very much more complicated than that. The thing is that when chemistry failed to satisfy me, really, I was in one of those situations in those days where if you didn't stay at college, at university, you had to go into the army for 2 years. And because I found myself really rather at a loss not knowing what I was going to do or who I was, I didn't want to spend 2 years in the army before I found out. And so I did what might not seem like the most logical thing. I borrowed £10 off my mother and went to France. and £10 was quite a lot then, but it was obviously not a huge amount of money. And I went to Paris. And I had a note from a clarinet, famous jazz clarinetist, who was also a newspaper cartoonist, and it was an introduction to a friend of his who managed a newspaper in Paris. It was an English language newspaper, like the whole trip. And I went to see him, among other people, and he gave me a job as a messenger boy. And I stood in the corner of his office on a pathetically small salary next to an alcoholic peasant called Andre, who was the other messenger. And I just stood there with nothing to do but look over the shoulder of the guy I was standing behind. And I could see that what he was doing didn't seem really very difficult. And one day he didn't turn up and there was nobody else in the office, so I sat and did his job for him because it involved sorting through all the news that had come in that day, and his job was to sort out what was worth publishing. So I did that job. I was 20, I think, at the time. And when they came in, they saw I could do it, so they let me go on doing it. The guy never came back. So that was really purely accidental. That's how I got into journalism. And I hung on in Paris for a while, They closed that paper down 3 months later, which put a swift end to my new journalistic career. And I hung on as long as I could, and then I came back to the UK and I did the army thing, because by then I began to feel a lot more confident about myself. So that's kind of how I got into newspapers.
I have a feeling you've been doing the same sort of thing ever since, just letting life's accidents determine your path.
I think that's the answer. I think that's the truth of it. And it's sort of semi-deliberate, I think. You know, I think I'm going to make a huge leap here and say that in all my wandering, one of the things that's really engaged me and cheered me up, discovery that there are people who do that kind of thing and change their careers magically, you know, and just sort of like a good example would be this guy I know who was a motorcycle courier in London, which is a really frightful job, except that you can make a lot of money quickly. It's dangerous and dirty. But he used his money to make these exotic journeys and until he found the place where he really wanted to be, and then he became a hotel manager in a fabulous resort town in the north of Brazil. And I thought, it's such a fabulous transformation, you know. And then there was another fellow who used to be an ice cream merchant in Essex, and instead he bought himself a little holiday place on Lake Malawi. When I see the kinds of wonderful lives there are to be lived in the world, it amazes me that there are so many people who slog away in miserable circumstances doing the same thing every day that they don't really want to do. You know, that's the argument in favor of letting things happen and staying open to opportunities of all kinds. It seems like accidental, but I think it's just being available, really, to anything that comes along, or that enables you to change and to grow as you go on, instead of being tied down to the same little treadmill.
Ted, what do you think stops most people from opening up and being available to change and grow? Do you have any theories?
The obvious ones, I suppose. A lot of it is rooted in fear, or anxiety. I think people are led into believing that they have to fulfill certain assignments that are given to them as they progress through life. They have to marry, they have to have children, they have to have a house, they have to have a career. That these things are necessary, and then once they get into that, it takes a great deal to shift them out of it. Another of the things that people back a bit is getting hooked up with somebody too early and finding that there isn't a whole lot of communication, and so people drag each other down rather. But I think a lack of aspiration, really. I think that's the secret, is to have something to strive for early on in life, so that you get used to the idea of wanting something valuable to happen to you in your life, and if it doesn't happen, then it makes you very, very uneasy. You can't put up with it. And I think that would be the central factor.
Mm-hmm. So some sort of ambition, aspiration to get something important done, get something valuable done.
Yeah, it's amazing how many young people don't have any idea what they want to do. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a failing of society, really, that kids aren't given that impetus early in life to recognize that there is something that they can do that's good, or something they really love. Give them the energy to actually work for it.
Yeah, I'm remembering. I saw on your website you talked to a school about water. You talked to a bunch of college students.
Half of them are asleep.
You had some really good advice here. I'm going to... here's the quote. Keep life simple. Reduce your overhead. Give yourself time and freedom to do what you know is right and worthwhile.
Good. This wonderful advice that I've been doling out recently was not really available to me when I was a young man. So I got into journalism, and I decided that was going to be a career, and I worked very hard at it and did pretty well, but wasn't very happy with the way newspapers were going. And I, it,
And also I had some personal problems. I discovered that I wasn't really very good with authority figures, and there were a bunch of them around, and I'm not an office competitor. I'm so good at that. And it was making me unhappy. Even though I was going up the ladder at a fair rate, I got to the point where I really didn't think I wanted to go on with that. And again, it was the same. It was that same impulse that just wouldn't let me do something that I really didn't feel was fulfilling.
Uh-huh.
So I stopped. But at the same time that I stopped, I somehow convinced myself that I really ought to get married because I was already 30 something, and everybody at that age is supposed to have a wife. So I married, and it wasn't a good marriage. It was, but she was a very nice woman. It's just that I wasn't really very nice, I think, and it didn't last very long. But it was during that whole period when I'd left the newspaper and lots of upheaval and so on that I finally did make the break that started me off on a whole new trajectory. I had a house and a mortgage and all those things, and I gave it all up because I discovered this ruin in the south of France, and which I bought for $1,000. And I don't know, there was something about it, something about the stone and the light and the simplicity of the life there that made me feel that this was almost like a spiritual home. I wouldn't have put it that way. And I just sold up. I sold everything up, and I moved into this ruin and just started doing stonemasonry. I had to make a bit of money, and so I started writing articles freelance because I had huge range of contacts by that time in Fleet Street. And I'd go back to London and get a small job and go off and do it. A lot of it was show business. I was very well placed to go to locations in Spain and Italy where they were filming. So I did a few jobs like that and brought the money back and spent it on lime and wood and white and red wine, which was very cheap, and lived in this ruin. And then I wrote a book. Well, that's when I discovered that it was actually suited my life better to write a book, because then you didn't have to go rushing around so much.
Uh-huh. And what was that book?
That was a book about, it was purely accidental again. It was a book about Grand Prix motor racing. And I knew absolutely nothing about the subject at all. But I'd been editor briefly of a magazine that I started in London, and two of the contributors were car racers. Jackie Stewart was one of them, and somebody had approached them and said, "Do you know anybody who could write a book about our new racing team?" And they said, "Why don't you ask Ted Simon?" And so I did the job. Most of the year I spent going to Grand Prix race circuit, and I wrote that book, and it wasn't a huge, it didn't make a lot of money, it just kept me going, but it was liked, and apparently it's still liked, by God. That was 1970.
Uh-huh.
And then a couple of years after that, I got really itchy feet. You know, once you start on this, it's really hard to stop. Once you start to expand your horizons, you realize how much further you have to go. You never actually get to the horizon, do you? There's always more. And I had a marvelous girlfriend who lived with me in France. And again, it must have a lot to do with me, because I don't think I was very good at at creating this sort of harmonious relationship that persuades people to stay at home and have babies and do all those things. Anyway, a couple of years on, I got very uneasy again and felt that I hadn't really seen enough. There's one thing that happened to me much earlier in life that, really is quite relevant to all this, and that is that while I was still at school, and this was just after the war, this would have been in 1947, I think, when most of Europe was still in ruins. I was already a Francophile. I really loved the idea of France. And I was desperate to see if it was true that the Mediterranean was blue. I couldn't believe that there could be such a thing as a blue ocean. Because all the sea around England is very gray.
Uh-huh.
And I got a bicycle and rode the bicycle to the Mediterranean. And it's only more recently, looking back on it, that I'm really quite astonished that I did that and that it never even occurred to me to ask anybody to go with me. And it was a very successful journey. I mean, it was only away for a month. But obviously that foreshadowed a lot of what happened later. I mean, just knowing that I could do that, that I was okay on my own, that I could do all this stuff. I think that's what really made it easy for me in 1973 to think of getting on a motorcycle and going around the world on it.
That does sound like a seminal moment. And I'm kind of astounded that you didn't think of, should I take a friend or should I get my girlfriend to go? Most people do. So what do you think, have you always been what you call a loner?
I suppose so, yes. Inevitably, yeah.
But you're so social. I know traveling is a wonderfully social pastime, but you get to leave, which is probably why relationships don't work, but on-the-road relationships do. I know we both have friends we see for a much longer time than we can hold down relationships. So I'm trying to get behind that too, Ted.
I know. It's really hard. I mean, All the women I really want to spend my life with are in places like Chile and Ukraine and and Australia and so on. You know, they're never around the corner.
Maybe that's what's attractive about them.
Somebody could have a ball sorting that out. I do remember very clearly at the beginning of that first big journey around the world, deciding quite specifically that it had to be alone. And my girlfriend, I think she would have come, but I think she's a very stern artist, a very good artist, and very very clear about what one has to sacrifice in order to do good art. And I think she saw this journey as a form of art. You know, she could see why I would have to do it on my own. So she went along with it.
Ahead a little bit to your did you know when you took this journey around the world that you were going to write a book? I know that you got some money writing articles during the trip for the newspapers.
Oh yes, absolutely. I not only because I needed to have something. Well, I did get an advance on the book, but the advance wasn't very much, but I did need all the money I could get my hands on. But mainly, it's just that I didn't think that just having the experience would be enough. I think that you have to use what you do in some way or other. I mean, because by then I really did think of myself as a writer, that was the natural direction to go in. And I think this is another really quite important element, I think, in making life really work. It's not just having experiences of one kind or another, but actually using the material in some way, developing something out of it. Transcending the actual experience and developing something more universal, dare I say profound, I don't know, doing something with it, because that's important for your self-esteem and your growth, and defends you against those people who say that all you're doing is just indulging yourself and having a good holiday at their expense.
So, Ted, I know that a lot of people do think that there is a perception of self-indulgence with writers and artists and dancers, but it is very, very difficult to actually make a living on your own. A freelance writer, yes, but to create a business like you have. You created Jupitalia, your own publishing house. You've had to learn the web. You've had to learn new ways of communicating. You've cooperated with people who wanted to make films about you. I want to talk about travel genre. You've had a lot of training and a lot of different kinds of writing, but how is it to be a business person around this? How hard is that for you?
I can't honestly say it's been hard. I do think I've been extremely fortunate, because I think I learned what I needed to know, the basic things I needed to know about the actual business of producing print when I was doing my apprenticeship back in the 60s in London. So the thought of having to deal with printers and page and advertising and publicity and all of that, that came very naturally out of what I was doing back then. And none of it is difficult. It's just the thought of it that can be difficult. I mean, there are things now that I would be afraid to start doing simply because I don't know where to begin. And when you don't know, and you don't know what's going to happen, when you can't see your way through something, you can easily imagine all kinds of things happen, drag you down into the gutter.
Some create inertia. But so your newspaper business experience helped you with your publishing business that you have now. What caused you to drop the big publishers and go on your own?
Oh, only because they dropped me. Publishing has become a total mess. That's obviously true. And I can look back far enough to the time when people, when publishers seemed to know what they were doing. I now begin to wonder whether they actually ever did. And I know that it's always been a risky business. But at least back in the days when I started to write, when I wrote my first book, there really wasn't any other way that people could get hold of that material except through a book. But now, of course, they can get at it in all kinds of ways. And in any case, people's interest in the printed word has... So, I was brought into the business at a simpler time. But my experience with this last book is a very good example of the way things are. It was almost accidental that the book got published at all. Even in the UK, because until Ewan McGregor and his mate Charlie decided that they wanted to go around sort of halfway around the world with their bikes, nobody was interested in my book. Even though Jupiter's Travels itself was still selling merrily through Penguin in the UK, Penguin weren't interested in another one. And nobody else was. And then Ewan McGregor and Charlie did this thing, and of course his celebrity was so great that the Little Brown, who bought the rights to publish the Ghosted book, did enormously well with it. And it's very interesting that neither Little Brown in Boston nor any other major publisher in the U.S. was in the least bit interested in publishing my book here.
Uh-huh.
The only reason I got into publishing in the first place was that when Jupiter's Travels first came out over here in the States in the 80s, it didn't do very well at all. And Penguin did 15,000 copies and sold them and then just let it go. And that was in 1985. And I was doing all sorts of other things, writing books about water and doing trips on foot and so on. I mean, I'm not by any means wedded to the motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
And it was only in 1995 that I discovered that there was a considerable audience of people engaged in motorcycling in the States who wanted my book and couldn't get it. I thought, well, here's an opportunity to get it around and make a little money as well.
And so you started Dupatalia, got your CBA, and started your website with... With
all
some help from friends, I do want to mention that. It seems that you have a lot of friends who are very willing to share their talents with you and help you along. These people are fans and personal friends and business acquaintances. How is that?
I don't know.
You really do really magically attract a lot of people who have shared enormously with you. I've read, you know, they feel that you've inspired them, and many of these people have gone on inspired by you to live their own dreams, not just motorcycle travel, but their break out of that treadmill that you spoke of earlier.
I do have an inordinate amount of pleasure in knowing that. It's true. I get emails now all the time. I used to get letters that, you know, from people saying thanks, giving me the courage to give up this god-awful job. And I do know people who've gone from being estate agents to airline pilots or done all sorts of extraordinary things just on account of reading my book. And I've no doubt other people's books are doing the same thing for other people. It's just that these days, with email, there's an opportunity for people to let you know that it's going on. And I don't know. I make myself available. I suppose that's the answer.
You do.
An awful lot of writers don't. There used to be a prejudice about writers that, you know, if you really wanted to avoid meeting them because they would always be a terrible disappointment.
Well, you're not, and I think, let me just throw this out. There is a tendency to want to make your own way in the world and create this little bubble of self-sufficiency about you. This just occurred to me, and I think maybe what you have, what I'm learning from you, is that you must have the ability to not only give, but to receive in kind. And I think that might be one of the lessons that I'm taking here today, is that you are able to receive help from all of these people that you've met, and that has assisted you in widening your horizons and everyone else's and actually making a living out of what you love to do.
I've got to say that it's often harder to receive than to give, because it invites a lot of criticism, self-criticism in a way. You know, you think, well, you know, all those people about who love to say that they don't take charity and so on. And it's a fine line between being helped and being given charity. And I think you have to have a pretty strong ego to be able to decide that it's okay to be helped, that what you're doing is valuable, and that for people to want to help you do something valuable is okay, and that you can accept it.
Uh-huh.
I have my moments of nervousness. I do, among other things, having been a newspaper man, I know very well that there's a human tendency to build people up and then tear them down. And so I'm constantly waiting for the world to say, oh, that Ted Simon, he's not what he's cracked up to be.
Don't think that's going to happen, Ted.
Well, important to keep those things in mind, I think. You know,
listen, what's next? I know on your website I had a good laugh. I emailed you and said, your life has grown into a huge, unmanageable conglomeration of things to do that get in the way of things that you want to finish, like your website and writing and being alone and building stuff and growing stuff and playing the piano and traveling. And so in the face of all of that, what is next for you?
I think all of those things, I can't believe that I'm, my life has tended always to go to kind of in jerks, you know, from one big thing to another big thing. But there are all these other things that I really like doing. I really like building and gardening and music and whatever else there is to do. I like all this stuff, and I think it's very important to be involved in as many different kinds of activity as possible.
Uh-huh.
And it's becoming harder for me to think of any one big thing that's going to put all that other stuff in the shade. And, you know, I'm already 76, for God's sake. It might be time to mellow out a bit. I don't know, but I don't have, in other words, I don't have what you would call of as a huge project, but there are books I want to write. So, I mean, any book is a big enough thing to have to deal with. I'd love to write a novel. I just don't know if I can ever get myself into a sufficiently undistracted state to be able to do it. But meanwhile, I have an awful lot of stuff to write about that I've been hoarding through all these decades. A lot of funny stuff, a lot of good stories.
Well, I look forward to reading anything. I hope you'll post some on your website in progress, perhaps, like some authors are doing today. Ted, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. You've given us a lot of good tips and inspiration for following a misadventurous lifestyle. I do want to mention that your website is jupitalia.com, J-U-P-I-T-A-L-I-A. And you can order the UK version of the book now and perhaps the American version soon.
I'm going to be putting that up on the website in the next couple of days, yeah. So the US edition will be there. It's cheaper. The UK edition is hardback. It costs more.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Ted Simon on the Misadventuring podcast, misadventuring.com. Thanks very much to our audio engineer guru, Brent Miller of Sojourn Chronicles. Visit him and his interview programs on sojournchronicles.com. Take a look at misadventuring.com soon. We've scheduled an interview with Serena Bartlett, the young publisher of a new guidebook series called Grassroots Travel. That's grass, R-O-U-T-E-S, travel, that focuses on the city next door. Her latest title is Oakland, the Soul of the City Next Door. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, may all your misadventures have happy endings.